Chapter 22. After the Burial. Patches of bright blue sky were beginning to appear over the castle turrets, but these signs of approaching summer did not lift Harry's mood. He had been thwarted both in his attempts to find out what Malfoy was doing and in his efforts to start a conversation with Slughorn that might lead, somehow, to Slughorn handing over the memory he had apparently suppressed for decades. "For the last time, just forget about Malfoy," Hermione told Harry firmly. They were sitting with Ron in a sunny corner of the courtyard after lunch. Hermione and Ron were both clutching a Ministry of Magic leaflet, Common Apparition Mistakes and How to Avoid Them, for they were taking their tests that very afternoon. But by and large the leaflets had not proved soothing to the nerves. Ron gave a start and tried to hide behind Hermione as a girl came round the corner. "It isn't lavender," said Hermione wearily. "Oh, good," said Ron, relaxing.
"Harry Potter," said the girl. "I was asked to give you this."
"Thanks." Harry's heart sank as he took the small scroll of parchment. Once the girl was out of earshot, he said, "Dumbledore said we wouldn't be having any more lessons until I got the memory."
"Maybe he wants to check on how you're doing," suggested Hermione, as Harry unrolled the parchment.
But rather than finding Dumbledore's long, narrow, slanting writing, he saw an untidy sprawl, very difficult to read, due to the presence of large blotches on the parchment where the ink had run. "Dear Harry, Ron, and Hermione, Aragog died last night. Harry and Ron, you met him, and you know how special he was. Hermione, I know you'd have liked him. It would mean a lot to me if you'd nipped down for the burial later this evening. I'm planning on doing it round dusk. That was his favourite time of day. I know you're not supposed to be out that late, but you can use the cloak. Wouldn't ask, but I can't face it alone. Hagrid." "Look at this," said Harry, handing the note to Hermione.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," she said, scanning it quickly and passing it to Ron, who read it through, looking increasingly incredulous. "He's mental," he said furiously. "That thing told its mates to eat Harry and me, told them to help themselves, and now Hagrid expects us to go down there and cry over its horrible hairy body."
"It's not just that," said Hermione. "He's asking us to leave the castle at night, and he knows security's a million times tighter, and how much trouble we'd be in if we were caught." "We've been down to see him by night before," said Harry.
"Yes, but for something like this," said Hermione. "We've risked a lot to help Hagrid out, but after all, Aragog's dead. If it were a question of saving him..."
"I'd want to go even less," said Ron firmly. "You didn't meet him, Hermione. Believe me, being dead will have improved him a lot." Harry took the note back and stared down at the inky blotches all over it. Tears had clearly fallen thick and fast upon the parchment.
"Harry, you can't be thinking of going," said Hermione. "It's such a pointless thing to get detention for."
Harry sighed. "Yeah, I know," he said. "I suppose Hagrid'll have to bury Aragog without us."
"Yes, he will," said Hermione, looking relieved. "Look, potions will be almost empty this afternoon, with us all off doing our tests. Try and soften Slughorn up a bit then."
57th time lucky, you think?" said Harry bitterly.
"Lucky," said Ron suddenly. "Harry, that's it. Get lucky."
"What do you mean?"
"Use your lucky potion." "Ron, that's it," said Hermione, sounding stunned. "Of course. Why didn't I think of it?"
Harry stared at them both. "Felix Felicis," he said. "I dunno, I was sort of saving it."
"What for?" demanded Ron incredulously. "What on earth is more important than this memory, Harry?" asked Hermione.
Harry did not answer.
The thought of that little golden bottle had hovered on the edges of his imagination for some time. Vague and unformulated plans that involved Ginny splitting up with Dean, and Ron somehow being happy to see her with a new boyfriend, had been fermenting in the depths of his brain, unacknowledged except during dreams or the twilight time between sleeping and waking.
"Harry, are you still with us?"
asked Hermione.
"What? Yeah, of course," he said, pulling himself together. "Well, okay. If I can't get Slughorn to talk this afternoon, I'll take some Felix and have another go this evening."
"That's decided, then," said Hermione briskly, getting to her feet and performing a graceful pirouette. "Destination, determination, deliberation," she murmured.
"Oh, stop that," Ron begged her. "I feel sick enough as it is. Quick, hide me!"
"It isn't lavender,"
said Hermione impatiently, as another couple of girls appeared in the courtyard and Ron dived behind her.
"Cool," said Ron, peering over Hermione's shoulder to check. "Blimey, they don't look happy, do they?"
"They're the Montgomery sisters, and of course they don't look happy. Didn't you hear what happened to their little brother?"
said Hermione.
"I'm losing track of what's happening to everyone's relatives, to be honest," said Ron.
"Well, their brother was attacked by a werewolf. The rumour is that their mother refused to help the Death Eaters. Anyway, the boy was only 5, and he died in St. Mungo's. They couldn't save him."
"He died?" repeated Harry, shocked.
"But surely werewolves don't kill. They just turn you into one of them."
"They sometimes kill," said Ron, who looked unusually grave now. "I've heard of it happening when the werewolf gets carried away."
"What was the werewolf's name?"
said Harry quickly.
"Well, the rumour is that it was that Fenrir Greyback," said Hermione.
"I knew it! The maniac who likes attacking kids, the one Lupin told me about,"
said Harry angrily. Hermione looked at him bleakly.
"Harry, you've got to get that memory," she said. "It's all about stopping Voldemort, isn't it? These dreadful things that are happening are all down to him."
The bell rang overhead in the castle, and both Hermione and Ron jumped to their feet, looking terrified.
"You'll do fine," Harry told them both, as they headed towards the entrance hall to meet the rest of the people taking their apparition test. "Good luck."
"And you too,"
said Hermione with a significant look, as Harry headed off to the dungeons. There were only 3 of them in potions that afternoon, Harry, Ernie, and Draco Malfoy.
"All too young to apparate just yet," said Slughorn genially. "Not turned 17 yet."
They shook their heads.
"Ah, well," said Slughorn cheerily. "As we're so few, we'll do something fun. I want you all to brew me up something amusing."
"That sounds good, sir,"
said Ernie sycophantically, rubbing his hands together. Malfoy, on the other hand, did not crack a smile.
"What do you mean, something amusing?" he said irritably.
"Oh, surprise me," said Slughorn airily.
Malfoy opened his copy of Advanced Potion-Making with a sulky expression. It could not have been plainer that he thought this lesson was a waste of time. Undoubtedly, Harry thought, watching him over the top of his own book, Malfoy was begrudging the time he could otherwise be spending in the Room of Requirement. Was it his imagination, or did Malfoy, like Tonks, look thinner? Certainly he looked paler. His skin still had that greyish tinge, probably because he so rarely saw daylight these days. But there was no air of smugness or excitement or superiority, none of the swagger that he had had on the Hogwarts Express when he had boasted openly of the mission he had been given by Voldemort. There could be only one conclusion, in Harry's opinion. The mission, whatever it was going badly. Cheered by this thought, Harry skimmed through his copy of Advanced Potion Making and found a heavily corrected Half-Blood Prince's version of An Elixir to Induce Euphoria, which seemed not only to meet Slughorn's instructions, but which might, Harry's heart leapt as the thought struck him, put Slughorn into such a good mood that he would be prepared to hand over that memory if Harry could persuade him to taste some.
"Well, now, this looks absolutely wonderful," said Slughorn, clapping his hands together an hour and a half later, as he stared down into the sunshine-yellow contents of Harry's cauldron. "Euphoria, I take it. And what's that I smell? You've added just a sprig of peppermint, haven't you? Unorthodox, but what a stroke of inspiration, Harry. Of course, that would tend to counterbalance the occasional side effects of excessive singing and nose-tweaking. I really don't know where you get these brainwaves, my boy. Unless..."
Harry pushed the Half-Blood Prince's book deeper into his bag with his foot.
"It's just your mother's genes coming out in you?"
"Oh, yeah, maybe," said Harry, relieved. Ernie was looking rather grumpy. Determined to outshine Harry for once, he had most rashly invented his own potion, which had curdled and formed a kind of purple dumpling at the bottom of his cauldron. Malfoy was already packing up, sour-faced. Slughorn had pronounced his hiccupping solution merely passable. The bell rang, and both Ernie and Malfoy left at once. "Sir," Harry began, but Slughorn immediately glanced over his shoulder. When he saw that the room was empty but for himself and Harry, he hurried away as fast as he could.
"Professor! Professor, don't you want to taste my po—"
called Harry desperately. But Slughorn had gone. Disappointed, Harry emptied the cauldron, packed up his things, left the dungeon, and walked slowly back upstairs to the common room. Ron and Hermione returned in the late afternoon.
"Harry!" cried Hermione as she climbed through the portrait hole. "Harry, I passed!"
"Well done!" he said.
"And Ron?" "He just failed,"
whispered Hermione, as Ron came slouching into the room, looking most morose.
"It was really unlucky, a tiny thing. The examiner just spotted that he'd left half an eyebrow behind. How did it go with Slughorn?"
"No joy," said Harry, as Ron joined them. "Bad luck, mate.
But you'll pass next time. We can take it together."
"Yeah, I suppose," said Ron grumpily.
"But half an eyebrow, like that matters!" "I know," said Hermione soothingly. "It does seem really harsh."
They spent most of their dinner roundly abusing the apparition examiner, and Ron looked fractionally more cheerful by the time they set off back to the common room, now discussing the continuing problem of Slughorn and the memory.
"So, Harry, you going to use the Felix Felicis or what?"
Ron demanded.
"Yeah, I suppose I'd better," said Harry. "I don't reckon I'll need all of it, not 12 hours' worth. It can't take all night. I'll just take a mouthful. 2 or 3 hours should do it."
"It's a great feeling when you take it,"
said Ron reminiscently.
"Like you can't do anything wrong."
"What are you talking about?" said Hermione, laughing. "You've never taken any."
"Yeah, but I thought I had, didn't I?" said Ron, as though explaining the obvious. "Same difference, really."
As they had only just seen Slughorn enter the Great Hall and knew that he liked to take time over meals, they lingered for a while in the common room, the plan being that Harry should go to Slughorn's office once the teacher had had time to get back there. When the sun had sunk to the level of the treetops in the Forbidden Forest, they decided the moment had come, and, after checking carefully that Neville, Dean and Seamus were all in the common room, sneaked up to the boys' dormitory. Harry took out the rolled-up socks at the bottom of his trunk and extracted the tiny, gleaming bottle.
"Well, here goes," said Harry,
and he raised the little bottle and took a carefully measured gulp.
"What does it feel like?"
whispered Hermione. Harry did not answer for a moment. Then, slowly but surely, an exhilarating sense of infinite opportunity stole through him. He felt as though he could have done anything, anything at all, and getting the memory from Slughorn seemed suddenly not only possible, but positively easy. He got to his feet, smiling, brimful of confidence. "Excellent," he said. "Really excellent. Right, I'm going down to Hagrid's."
"What?"
said Ron and Hermione together, looking aghast.
"No, Harry, you've got to go and see Slughorn, remember?" said Hermione.
"No," said Harry confidently. "I'm going to Hagrid's. I've got a good feeling about going to Hagrid's."
"You've got a good feeling about burying a giant spider?" asked Ron, looking stunned.
"Yeah," said Harry, pulling his invisibility cloak out of his bag. "I feel like it's the place to be tonight. You know what I mean?"
"No," said Ron and Hermione together, both looking positively alarmed now.
"This is Felix Felicis, I suppose,"
said Hermione anxiously, holding up the bottle to the light.
"You haven't got another little bottle full of, I don't know, essence of insanity?" suggested Ron, as Harry swung his cloak over his shoulders.
Harry laughed, and Ron and Hermione looked even more alarmed.
"Trust me," he said. "I know what I'm doing. Or at least," he strolled confidently to the door, "Felix does."
He pulled the invisibility cloak over his head and set off down the stairs, Ron and Hermione hurrying along behind him. At the foot of the stairs, Harry slid through the open door.
"What were you doing up there with her?"
shrieked Lavender Brown, staring right through Harry at Ron and Hermione emerging together from the boys' dormitories. Harry heard Ron spluttering behind him as he darted across the room away from them. Getting through the portrait hole was simple. As he approached it, Ginny and Dean came through it, and Harry was able to slip between them. As he did so, he brushed accidentally against Ginny.
"Don't push me, please, Dean," she said, sounding annoyed. "You're always doing that. I can get through perfectly well on my own."
The portrait swung closed behind Harry, but not before he had heard Dean make an angry retort. His feeling of elation increasing, Harry strode off through the castle. He did not have to creep along, for he met nobody on his way. But this did not surprise him in the slightest. This evening he was the luckiest person at Hogwarts. Why he knew that going to Hagrid's was the right thing to do, he had no idea. It was as though the potion was illuminating a few steps of the path at a time. He could not see the final destination. He could not see where Slughorn came in, but he knew that he was going the right way to get that memory. When he reached the entrance hall, he saw that Filch had forgotten to lock the front door. Beaming, Harry threw it open and breathed in the smell of clean air and grass for a moment before walking down the steps into the dusk. It was when he reached the bottom step that it occurred to him how very pleasant it would be to pass the vegetable patch on his walk to Hagrid's. It was not strictly on the way, but it seemed clear to Harry that this was a whim on which he should act, so he directed his feet immediately towards the vegetable patch, where he was pleased, but not altogether surprised, to find Professor Slughorn in conversation with Professor Sprout. Harry lurked behind a low stone wall, feeling at peace with the world and listening to their conversation.
"I do thank you for taking the time, Pomona," Slughorn was saying courteously. "Most authorities agree that they are picked at their most efficacious if picked at twilight."
"Oh, I quite agree," said Professor Sprout warmly. "That enough for you?"
"Plenty, plenty," said Slughorn, who, Harry saw, was carrying an armful of leafy plants.
This should allow for a few leaves for each of my third years, and some to spare, if anybody overstews them. Well, good evening to you, and many thanks again."
Professor Sprout headed off into the gathering darkness in the direction of her greenhouses, and Slughorn directed his steps to the spot where Harry stood, invisible. Seized with an immediate desire to reveal himself, Harry pulled off the cloak with a flourish.
"Good evening, Professor." "Merlin's beard, Harry, you made me jump," said Slughorn, stopping dead in his tracks and looking wary. "How did you get out of the castle?" "I think Filch must have forgotten to lock the doors," said Harry cheerfully, and was delighted to see Slughorn's scowl.
"I'll be reporting that man. He's more concerned about litter than proper security, if you ask me. But why are you out here, Harry?"
"Well, sir, it's Hagrid," said Harry, who knew that the right thing to do just now was to tell the truth. "He's pretty upset. But you won't tell anyone, Professor. I don't want trouble for him." Slughorn's curiosity was evidently aroused.
"Well, I can't promise that," he said gruffly. "But I know that Dumbledore trusts Hagrid to the hilt, so I'm sure he can't be up to anything very dreadful."
"Well, it's this giant spider. He's had it for years. It lived in the forest. It could talk and everything."
"I heard rumours there were acromantula in the forest," said Slughorn softly, looking over at the mass of black trees. "It's true, then?"
"Yes," said Harry, "but this one, Aragog, the first one Hagrid ever got, it died last night. He's devastated. He wants company while he buries it, and I said I'd go."
"Touching, touching," said Slughorn absent-mindedly, his large, droopy eyes fixed upon the distant lights of Hagrid's cabin. "But acromantula venom is very valuable. If the beast has only just died, it might not yet have dried out. Of course, I wouldn't want to do anything insensitive if Hagrid is upset, but if there were any way to procure some... I mean, it's almost impossible to get venom from an acromantula while it's alive."
Slughorn seemed to be talking more to himself than Harry now.
"Seems an awful waste not to collect it. Might get 100 gallons a pint. To be frank, my salary is not large."
And now Harry saw clearly what was to be done.
"Well," he said, with a most convincing hesitancy, "well, if you wanted to come, Professor, Hagrid would probably be really pleased. Give Aragog a better send-off, you know."
"Yes, of course,"
said Slughorn, his eyes now gleaming with enthusiasm.
"I tell you what, Harry, I'll meet you down there with a bottle or two. We'll drink the poor beast's, well, not health, but we'll send it off in style, anyway, once it's buried. And I'll change my tie. This one is a little exuberant for the occasion."
He bustled back into the castle, and Harry sped off to Hagrid's, delighted with himself.
"You came," croaked Hagrid,
when he opened the door and saw Harry emerging from the invisibility cloak in front of him.
"Yeah, Ron and Hermione couldn't, though," said Harry. "They're really sorry."
Don't matter. It'd have been touchier here, though, Harry."
Hagrid gave a great sob. He had made himself a black armband out of what looked like a rag dipped in boot polish, and his eyes were puffy, red, and swollen. Harry patted him consolingly on the elbow, which was the highest point of Hagrid he could easily reach.
"Where are we burying him?" he asked.
"The forest?"
"Blimey, no,"
said Hagrid, wiping his streaming eyes on the bottom of his shirt.
"The other spiders won't let me anywhere near their webs now Aragog's gone. Turns out it was only on his orders they didn't eat me. Can you believe that, Harry?"
The honest answer was yes. Harry recalled with painful ease the scene when he and Ron had come face to face with the acromantula. They had been quite clear that Aragog was the only thing that stopped them eating Hagrid.
"Never been an area of the forest I couldn't go before,"
said Hagrid, shaking his head.
It wasn't easy getting Aragog's body out of there, I can tell you.
They usually eat their dead, see? But I wanted to give him a nice burial, a proper send-off.
He broke into sobs again, and Harry resumed the patting of his elbow, saying as he did so, for the potion seemed to indicate that it was the right thing to do, "Professor Slughorn met me coming down here, Hagrid."
"Not in trouble, are you?" said Hagrid, looking up, alarmed. "You shouldn't be out of the castle in the evening, I know it. It's my fault."
"No, no. When he heard what I was doing, he said he'd like to come and pay his last respects to Aragog too," said Harry. "He's gone to change into something more suitable, I think, and he said he'd bring some bottles so we can drink to Aragog's memory."
"Did he?"
said Hagrid, looking both astonished and touched.
That's right nice of him, that is, and not turning you in either. I've never really had a lot to do with Horace Slughorn before. Coming to see old Aragog off, though, eh? Well, in a light that, Aragog would."
Harry thought privately that what Aragog would have liked most about Slughorn was the ample amount of edible flesh he provided, but he merely moved to the rear window of Hagrid's hut, where he saw the rather horrible sight of the enormous dead spider lying on its back outside, its legs curled and tangled. "Are we going to bury him here, Hagrid? In your garden?"
"Just beyond the pumpkin patch, I thought," said Hagrid in a choked voice. "I've already dug the, you know, grave. Just thought we'd say a few nice things over him. Happy memories, you know."
His voice quivered and broke. There was a knock on the door, and he turned to answer it, blowing his nose on his great spotted handkerchief as he did so. Slughorn hurried over the threshold, several bottles in his arms, and wearing a sombre black cravat.
"Hagrid," he said in a deep, grave voice, "so very sorry to hear of your loss." "That's very nice of you," said Hagrid. "Thanks a lot. And thanks for not giving Harry detention, neither." "Wouldn't have dreamed of it," said Slughorn. "Sad night. Sad night. Where is the poor creature?"
"Out here," said Hagrid in a shaky voice.
Shall we do it, then?"
The three of them stepped out into the back garden. The moon was glistening palely through the trees, and its rays mingled with the light spilling from Hagrid's window to illuminate Aragog's body, lying on the edge of a massive pit, beside a 10-foot-high mound of freshly dug earth.
"Magnificent,"
said Slughorn, approaching the spider's head, where 8 milky eyes stared blankly at the sky, and 2 huge curved pincers shone, motionless in the moonlight. Harry thought he heard the tinkle of bottles as Slughorn bent over the pincers, apparently examining the enormous hairy head.
"It's not everyone appreciates how beautiful they are," said Hagrid to Slughorn's back, tears leaking from the corners of his crinkled eyes. "I didn't know you were interested in creatures like Aragog, Horace."
"Interested, my dear Hagrid, I revere them," said Slughorn, stepping back from the body.
Harry saw the glint of a bottle disappear beneath his cloak, though Hagrid, mopping his eyes once more, noticed nothing.
"Now, shall we proceed to the burial?"
Hagrid nodded and moved forwards. He heaved the gigantic spider into his arms and, with an enormous grunt, rolled it into the dark pit. It hit the bottom with a rather horrible, crunchy thud. Hagrid started to cry again.
"Of course it's difficult for you who knew him best," said Slughorn, who, like Harry, could reach no higher than Hagrid's elbow, but patted it all the same. "Why don't I say a few words?"
He must have got a lot of good quality venom from Aragog, Harry thought, for Slughorn wore a satisfied smirk as he stepped up to the rim of the pit and said in a slow, impressive voice,
"Farewell, Aragog, King of Arachnids,
whose long and faithful friendship those who knew you won't forget. Though your body will decay, your spirit lingers on in the quiet, web-spun places of your forest home. May your many-eyed descendants ever flourish, and your human friends find solace for the loss they have sustained.
That was beautiful, howled Hagrid, and he collapsed onto the compost heap, crying harder than ever.
There, there, said Slughorn, waving his wand, so that the huge pile of earth rose up and then fell with a muffled sort of crash onto the dead spider, forming a smooth mound.
Let's get inside and have a drink. Get on his other side, Harry. That's it. Up you come, Hagrid. Well done.
They deposited Hagrid in a chair at the table. Fang, who had been skulking in his basket during the burial, now came padding softly across to them and put his heavy head into Harry's lap as usual. Slughorn uncorked one of the bottles of wine he had brought.
"I have had it all tested for poison," he assured Harry, pouring most of the first bottle into one of Hagrid's bucket-sized mugs and handing it to Hagrid.
"Had a house-elf taste every bottle after what happened to your poor friend Rupert."
Harry saw, in his mind's eye, the expression on Hermione's face if she ever heard about this abuse of house-elves, and decided never to mention it to her.
"One for Harry," said Slughorn, dividing a second bottle between two mugs, "and one for me. Well,"
he raised his mug high,
"to Aragog."
"Aragog," said Harry and Hagrid together. Both Slughorn and Hagrid drank deeply. Harry, however, with the way ahead illuminated for him by Felix Felicis, knew that he must not drink, so he merely pretended to take a gulp, and then set the mug back on the table before him.
"I had him from an egg, you know," said Hagrid morosely. "Tiny little thing he was when he hatched, about the size of a Pekingese."
"Sweet," said Slughorn.
"Used to keep him in a cupboard up at the school until, well."
Hagrid's face darkened, and Harry knew why. Tom Riddle had contrived to have Hagrid thrown out of school, blamed for opening the Chamber of Secrets. Slughorn, however, did not seem to be listening. He was looking up at the ceiling, from which a number of brass pots hung, and also a long, silky skein of bright white hair.
"That's never unicorn hair, Hagrid."
"Oh, yeah," said Hagrid indifferently. "Gets pulled out of their tails. They catch it on branches and stuff in the forest, you know."
"But, my dear chap, do you know how much that's worth?"
"I use it for binding on bandages and stuff if a creature gets injured," said Hagrid, shrugging. "It's dead useful. Very strong, see?"
Slughorn took another deep draught from his mug, his eyes moving carefully around the cabin now, looking, Harry knew, for more treasures that he might be able to convert into a plentiful supply of oak-matured mead, crystallized pineapple, and velvet smoking jackets. He refilled Hagrid's mug and his own, and questioned him about the creatures that lived in the forest these days, and how Hagrid was able to look after them all. Hagrid, becoming expansive under the influence of the drink and Slughorn's flattering interest, stopped mopping his eyes and entered happily into a long explanation of Beau Truckle husbandry. The Felix Felicis gave Harry a little nudge at this point, and he noticed that the supply of drink that Slughorn had brought was running out fast. Harry had not yet managed to bring off the refilling charm without saying the incantation aloud, but the idea that he might not be able to do it tonight was laughable. Indeed, Harry grinned to himself as, unnoticed by either Hagrid or Slughorn, now swapping tales of the illegal trade in dragon eggs, He pointed his wand under the table at the emptying bottles, and they immediately began to refill. After an hour or so, Hagrid and Slughorn began making extravagant toasts to Hogwarts, to Dumbledore, to elf-made wine, and to
Harry Potter,
bellowed Hagrid, slopping some of his 14th bucket of wine down his chin as he drained it.
Yes, indeed, cried Slughorn a little thickly. Perry Otter, the chosen boy who, well, something of that sort, he mumbled,
and drained his mug too. Not long after this, Hagrid became tearful again and pressed the whole unicorn tail upon Slughorn, who pocketed it with cries of,
To friendship, to generosity, to 10 galleons a hair!
And for a while after that, Hagrid and Slughorn were sitting side by side, arms around each other, singing a slow, sad song about a dying wizard called Odo.
The good die young,
muttered Hagrid, slumping low onto the table, a little cross-eyed, while Slughorn continued to warble the refrain.
My dad was no age to go. Nor were your mum and dad, Harry.
Great fat tears oozed out of the corners of Hagrid's crinkled eyes again. He grasped Harry's arm and shook it.
Best wizard and witcher to their age I never knew. Terrible thing. Terrible thing.
Slughorn sang plaintively,
And Odo the hero, they bore him back home to the place that he'd known as a lad. They laid him to rest with his hat inside out, and his wand snapped in two, which was sad. Terrible,
Hagrid grunted, and his great shaggy head rolled sideways onto his arms, and he fell asleep, snoring deeply.
Sorry, said Slughorn with a hiccup. Can't carry a tune to save my life.
Hagrid wasn't talking about your singing, said Harry quietly. He was talking about my mum and dad dying.
Oh, said Slughorn, repressing a large belch. Oh, dear. Yes, that was terrible indeed. Terrible. Terrible.
He looked quite at a loss for what to say, and resorted to refilling their mugs.
I don't suppose you remember it, Harry?
He asked awkwardly. No. Well, I was only one when they died, said Harry, his eyes on the flame of the candle flickering in Hagrid's heavy snores. But I've found out pretty much what happened since. My dad died first. Did you know that?
I didn't,
said Slughorn in a hushed voice. Yeah, Voldemort murdered him and then stepped over his body towards my mum, said Harry. Slughorn gave a great shudder, but he did not seem able to tear his horrified gaze away from Harry's face. He told her to get out of the way, said Harry remorselessly. He told me she needn't have died. He only wanted me. She could have run.
Oh, dear, breathed Slughorn. She could have. She needn't. That's awful.
It is, isn't it? Said Harry in a voice barely more than a whisper. But she didn't move. Dad was already dead, but she didn't want me to go too. She tried to plead with Voldemort, but he just laughed.
That's enough,
said Slughorn suddenly, raising a shaking hand.
Really, my dear boy, enough. I'm an old man. I don't need to hear. I don't want to hear.
I forgot, lied Harry, Felix Felicis leading him on. You liked her, didn't you?
liked her,"
said Slughorn, his eyes brimming with tears once more.
"I don't imagine anyone who met her wouldn't have liked her. Very brave, very funny. It was the most horrible thing."
"But you won't help her son," said Harry. "She gave me her life, but you won't give me a memory." Hagrid's rumbling snores filled the cabin. Harry looked steadily into Slughorn's tear-filled eyes. The potions master seemed unable to look away.
"Don't say that," he whispered. "It isn't a question. If it were to help you, of course, but no purpose could be served."
"It can," said Harry clearly. "Dumbledore needs information. I need information." He knew he was safe. Felix was telling him that Slughorn would remember nothing of this in the morning. Looking Slughorn straight in the eye, Harry leant forwards a little. "I am the Chosen One. I have to kill him. I need that memory." Slughorn turned paler than ever. His shiny forehead gleamed with sweat.
"You are the Chosen One?"
"Of course I am," said Harry calmly.
"But then, my dear boy, you're asking a great deal. You're asking me, in fact, to aid you in your attempt to destroy—"
"You don't want to get rid of the wizard who killed Lily Evans?"
"Harry, Harry, of course I do, but—"
"You're scared he'll find out you helped me?" Slughorn said nothing. He looked terrified. "Be brave, like my mother, Professor." Slughorn raised a pudgy hand and pressed his shaking fingers to his mouth. He looked for a moment like an enormously overgrown baby.
"I am not proud," he whispered through his fingers. "I am ashamed of what that memory shows. I think I may have done great damage that day."
"You'd cancel out anything you did by giving me the memory," said Harry. "It would be a very brave and noble thing to do." Hagrid twitched in his sleep and snored on. Slughorn and Harry stared at each other over the guttering candle. There was a long, long silence. But Felix Felicis told Harry not to break it, to wait. Then, very slowly, Slughorn put his hand in his pocket and pulled out his wand. He put his other hand inside his cloak and took out a small, empty bottle. Still looking into Harry's eyes, Slughorn touched the tip of his wand to his temple and withdrew it, so that a long, silver thread of memory came away too, clinging to the wand tip. Longer and longer the memory stretched until it broke and swung silvery bright from the wand. Slughorn lowered it into the bottle, where it coiled, then spread, swirling like gas. He corked the bottle with a trembling hand and then passed it across the table to Harry. "Thank you very much, Professor."
"You're a good boy,"
said Professor Slughorn, tears trickling down his fat cheeks into his walrus moustache.
"And you've got her eyes. Just don't think too badly of me once you've seen it."
And he, too, put his head on his arms, gave a deep sigh, and fell asleep. Chapter 23 Horcruxes. Harry could feel the Felix Felicis wearing off as he crept back into the castle. The front door had remained unlocked for him, but on the third floor he met Peeves, and only narrowly avoided detection by diving sideways through one of his shortcuts. By the time he got up to the portrait of the fat lady and pulled off his invisibility cloak, he was not surprised to find her in a most unhelpful mood.
"What sort of time do you call this?"
"I'm really sorry. I had to go out for something important."
"Well, the password changed at midnight, so you'll just have to sleep in the corridor, won't you?"
"You're joking," said Harry.
"Why did it have to change at midnight?" "That's the way it is," said the fat lady. "If you're angry, go and take it up with the headmaster. He's the one who's tightened security."
"Fantastic," said Harry bitterly, looking around at the hard floor. "Really brilliant. Yeah, I would go and take it up with Dumbledore if he was here, because he's the one who wanted me to—"
"He is here," said a voice behind Harry. "Professor Dumbledore returned to the school an hour ago."
Nearly headless Nick was gliding towards Harry, his head wobbling as usual upon his ruff.
"I had it from the bloody Baron who saw him arrive," said Nick. "He appeared, according to the Baron, to be in good spirits, though a little tired, of course."
"Where is he?" said Harry, his heart leaping.
"Oh, groaning and clanking up on the astronomy tower. It's a favourite pastime of his."
"Not the bloody Baron, Dumbledore."
"Oh, in his office," said Nick. "I believe, from what the Baron said, that he had business to attend to before turning in."
"Yeah, he has," said Harry, excitement blazing in his chest at the prospect of telling Dumbledore he had secured the memory. He wheeled about and sprinted off again, ignoring the fat lady who was calling after him.
"Come back! All right, I lied. I was annoyed you woke me up. The password's still tapeworm."
But Harry was already hurtling back along the corridor, and within minutes he was saying, "Toffee eclairs!" to Dumbledore's gargoyle, which leapt aside, permitting Harry entrance onto the spiral staircase.
"Enter," said Dumbledore, when Harry knocked.
He sounded exhausted. Harry pushed open the door. There was Dumbledore's office, looking the same as ever, but with black, star-strewn skies beyond the windows.
"Good gracious, Harry,"
said Dumbledore in surprise. "To what do I owe this very late pleasure?"
"Sir, I've got it. I've got the memory from Slughorn."
Harry pulled out the tiny glass bottle and showed it to Dumbledore. For a moment or two, the headmaster looked stunned. Then his face split in a wide smile.
"Harry, this is spectacular news. Very well done indeed. I knew you could do it."
All thought of the lateness of the hour apparently forgotten, he hurried around his desk, took the bottle with Slughorn's memory in his uninjured hand, and strode over to the cabinet where he kept the pensieve. "And now," said Dumbledore, placing the stone basin upon his desk and emptying the contents of the bottle into it, "now at last we shall see. Harry, quickly." Harry bowed obediently over the pensieve and felt his feet leave the office floor. Once again he fell through darkness and landed in Horace Slughorn's office many years before. There was the much younger Horace Slughorn, with his thick, shiny, straw-coloured hair and his gingery blonde moustache, sitting again in the comfortable winged armchair in his office, his feet resting upon a velvet pouf, a small glass of wine in one hand, the other rummaging in a box of crystallised pineapple. And there were the half a dozen teenage boys sitting around Slughorn, with Tom Riddle in the midst of them, Marvolo's gold and black ring gleaming on his finger. Dumbledore landed beside Harry just as Riddle asked,
"Sir, is it true that Professor Merrythought is retiring?"
"Tom, Tom, if I knew, I couldn't tell you," said Slughorn, wagging his finger reprovingly at Riddle, though winking at the same time. "I must say, I'd like to know where you get your information, boy. More knowledgeable than half the staff you are."
Riddle smiled. The other boys laughed and cast him admiring looks.
"What with your uncanny ability to know things you shouldn't, and your careful flattery of the people who matter—thank you for the pineapple, by the way. You're quite right. It is my favourite."
Several of the boys tittered again.
"I confidently expect you to rise to Minister for Magic within 20 years. 15, if you keep sending me pineapple. I have excellent contacts at the Ministry."
Tom Riddle merely smiled as the others laughed again. Harry noticed that he was by no means the eldest of the group of boys, but that they all seemed to look to him as their leader.
"I don't know that politics would suit me, sir," he said when the laughter had died away. "I don't have the right kind of background, for one thing."
A couple of the boys around him smirked at each other. Harry was sure they were enjoying a private joke, undoubtedly about what they knew or suspected regarding their gang leader's famous ancestor.
"Nonsense," said Slughorn briskly. "Couldn't be plainer. You come from decent wizarding stock, abilities like yours. No, you'll go far, Tom. I've never been wrong about a student yet."
The small golden clock standing upon Slughorn's desk chimed 11 o'clock behind him, and he looked round.
"Good gracious, is it that time already? You'd better get going, boys, or we'll all be in trouble. Lestrange, I want your essay by tomorrow, or it's detention. Same goes for you, Avery."
One by one, the boys filed out of the room. Slughorn heaved himself out of his armchair and carried his empty glass over to his desk. A movement behind him made him look round. Riddle was still standing there.
"Look sharp, Tom. You don't want to be caught out of bed, out of hours, and you a prefect."
"Sir, I wanted to ask you something."
"Ask away, then, my boy. Ask away."
"Sir, I wondered what you know about Horcruxes."
Slughorn stared at him, his thick fingers absent-mindedly caressing the stem of his wine glass.
"Project for Defence Against the Dark Arts, is it?"
But Harry could tell that Slughorn knew perfectly well that this was not schoolwork.
"Not exactly, sir," said Riddle. "I came across the term while reading, and I didn't fully understand it."
"No. Well, you'd be hard-pushed to find a book at Hogwarts that'll give you details on Horcruxes, Tom. That's very dark stuff. Very dark indeed," said Slughorn.
"But you obviously know all about them, sir. I mean, a wizard like you.
Sorry, I mean, if you can't tell me, obviously.
I just knew if anyone could tell me, you could. So I just thought I'd ask."
It was very well done, thought Harry. The hesitancy, the casual tone, the careful flattery, none of it overdone. He, Harry, had had too much experience of trying to wheedle information out of reluctant people not to recognise a master at work. He could tell that Riddle wanted the information very, very much, perhaps had been working towards this moment for weeks.
"Well," said Slughorn, not looking at Riddle, but fiddling with the ribbon on top of his box of crystallised pineapple. "Well, it can't hurt to give you an overview, of course, just so that you understand the term. A horcrux is the word used for an object in which a person has concealed part of their soul."
"I don't quite understand how that works, though, sir," said Riddle. His voice was carefully controlled, but Harry could sense his excitement.
"Well, you split your soul, you see," said Slughorn, "and hide part of it in an object outside the body. Then, even if one's body
is attacked or destroyed, one cannot die, for part of the soul remains earthbound and undamaged. But, of course, existence in such a form...
Slughorn's face crumpled, and Harry found himself remembering words he had heard nearly 2 years before.
I was ripped from my body. I was less than spirit, less than the meanest ghost, but still I was alive.
Few would want it, Tom, very few. Death would be preferable.
But Riddle's hunger was now apparent. His expression was greedy. He could no longer hide his longing.
How do you split your soul?
Well, said Slughorn uncomfortably, you must understand that the soul is supposed to remain intact and whole. Splitting it is an act of violation. It is against nature.
But how do you do it?
By an act of evil, the supreme act of evil. By committing murder, killing rips the soul apart. The wizard intent upon creating a horcrux would use the damage to his advantage. He would encase the torn portion.
Encase? But how?
There is a spell. Do not ask me, I don't know,
said Slughorn, shaking his head like an old elephant bothered by mosquitoes.
Do I look as though I have tried it? Do I look like a killer?
No, sir, of course not, said Riddle quickly. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend.
Not at all, not at all, not offended, said Slughorn gruffly. It's natural to feel some curiosity about these things. Wizards of a certain caliber have always been drawn to that aspect of magic.
Yes, sir, said Riddle. What I don't understand, though, just out of curiosity, I mean, would one horcrux be much use? Can you only split your soul once? Wouldn't it be better, make you stronger, to have your soul in more pieces? I mean, for instance, isn't 7... the most powerfully magical number? Wouldn't 7...
Merlin's beard, Tom! Yelped Slughorn. 7? Isn't it bad enough to think of killing one person? And in any case, bad enough to divide the soul, but to rip it into 7 pieces?
Slughorn looked deeply troubled now. He was gazing at Riddle as though he had never seen him plainly before, and Harry could tell that he was regretting entering into the conversation at all.
"Of course," he muttered, "this is all hypothetical, what we're discussing, isn't it? All academic."
"Yes, sir, of course," said Riddle quickly.
"But all the same, Tom, keep it quiet, what I've told, that's to say, what we've discussed. People wouldn't like to think we've been chatting about horcruxes. It's a banned subject at Hogwarts, you know. Dumbledore's particularly fierce about it."
"I won't say a word, sir," said Riddle,
and he left, but not before Harry had glimpsed his face, which was full of that same wild happiness it had worn when he had first found out that he was a wizard, the sort of happiness that did not enhance his handsome features, but made them somehow less human.
"Thank you, Harry," said Dumbledore quietly. "Let us go."
When Harry landed back on the office floor, Dumbledore was already sitting down behind his desk. Harry sat too, and waited for Dumbledore to speak.
"I have been hoping for this piece of evidence for a very long time," said Dumbledore at last.
"It confirms the theory on which I have been working. It tells me that I am right, and also how very far there is still to go."
Harry suddenly noticed that every single one of the old headmasters and headmistresses in the portraits around the walls was awake and listening in on their conversation. A corpulent, red-nosed wizard had actually taken out an ear trumpet.
"Well, Harry," said Dumbledore, "I am sure you understood the significance of what we just heard."
at the same age as you are now, give or take a few months, Tom Riddle was doing all he could to find out how to make himself immortal.
"You think he succeeded then, sir?" asked Harry.
"He made a Horcrux, and that's why he didn't die when he attacked me. He had a Horcrux hidden somewhere. A bit of his soul was safe."
"A bit or more," said Dumbledore. "You heard Voldemort. What he particularly wanted from Horace was an opinion on what would happen to the wizard who created more than one Horcrux. What would happen to the wizard so determined to evade death that he would be prepared to murder many times, rip his soul repeatedly, so as to store it in many separately concealed Horcruxes. No book would have given him that information. As far as I know, as far, I am sure, as Voldemort knew, no wizard had ever done more than tear his soul in two." Dumbledore paused for a moment, marshalling his thoughts, and then said, "4 years ago, I received what I considered certain proof that Voldemort had split his soul."
"Where?" asked Harry.
"How?"
"You handed it to me, Harry," said Dumbledore. "The diary, Riddle's diary, the one giving instructions on how to reopen the Chamber of Secrets."
"I don't understand, sir," said Harry.
"Well, although I did not see the riddle who came out of the diary, what you described to me was a phenomenon I had never witnessed. A mere memory starting to act and think for itself? A mere memory sapping the life out of the girl into whose hands it had fallen? No, something much more sinister had lived inside that book. A fragment of soul. I was almost sure of it. The diary had been a Horcrux, but this raised as many questions as it answered. What intrigued and alarmed me most was that that diary had been intended as a weapon as much as a safeguard."
"I still don't understand," said Harry.
"Well, it worked as a Horcrux is supposed to work. In other words, the fragment of soul concealed inside it was kept safe, and had undoubtedly played its part in preventing the death of its owner. But there could be no doubt that Riddle really wanted that diary read, wanted the piece of his soul to inhabit or possess somebody else, so that Slytherin's monster would be unleashed again."
"Well, he didn't want his hard work to be wasted," said Harry.
"He wanted people to know he was Slytherin's heir, because he couldn't take credit at the time."
"Quite correct," said Dumbledore, nodding. "But don't you see, Harry, that if he intended the diary to be passed to, or planted on, some future Hogwarts student, he was being remarkably blasé about that precious fragment of his soul concealed within it. The point of a Horcrux is, as Professor Slughorn explained, to keep part of the self hidden and safe, not to fling it into somebody else's path and run the risk that they might destroy it, as indeed happened. That particular fragment of soul is no more. You saw to that. The careless way in which Voldemort regarded this Horcrux seemed most ominous to me. It suggested that he must have made, or been planning to make, more Horcruxes, so that the loss of his first would not be so detrimental. I did not wish to believe it, but nothing else seemed to make sense. Then you told me, 2 years later, that on the night that Voldemort returned to his body, he made a most illuminating and alarming statement to his Death Eaters. I, who have gone further than anybody along the path that leads to immortality. That was what you told me, he said. Further than anybody. And I thought I knew what that meant, though the Death Eaters did not. He was referring to his Horcruxes. Horcruxes in the plural, Harry, which I do not believe any other wizard has ever had. Yet it fitted,
Lord Voldemort had seemed to grow less human with the passing years, and the transformation he had undergone seemed to me to be only explicable if his soul was mutilated beyond the realms of what we might call usual evil. "So he's made himself impossible to kill by murdering other people," said Harry. "Why couldn't he make a philosopher's stone or steal one if he was so interested in immortality?"
"Well, we know that he tried to do just that 5 years ago," said Dumbledore. "But there are several reasons why I think a philosopher's stone would appeal less than Horcruxes to Lord Voldemort. While the elixir of life does indeed extend life, it must be drunk regularly for all eternity if the drinker is to maintain his immortality. Therefore, Voldemort would be entirely dependent on the elixir, and if it ran out, or was contaminated, or if the stone was stolen, he would die, just like any other man. Voldemort likes to operate alone, remember. I believe that he would have found the thought of being dependent, even on the elixir, intolerable. Of course, he was prepared to drink it if it would take him out of the horrible part life to which he was condemned after attacking you, but only to regain a body. Thereafter, I am convinced, he intended to continue to rely on his Horcruxes. He would need nothing more if only he could regain a human form. He was already immortal, you see, or as close to immortal as any man can be. But now, Harry, armed with this information, the crucial memory you have succeeded in procuring for us, we are closer to the secret of finishing Lord Voldemort than anyone has ever been before. You heard him, Harry. Wouldn't it be better, make you stronger, to have your soul in more pieces? Isn't 7 the most powerfully magical number? Isn't 7 the most powerfully magical number? Yes, I think the idea of a 7-part soul would greatly appeal to Lord Voldemort.
He made 7 Horcruxes? Said Harry, horror-struck, while several of the portraits on the walls made similar noises of shock and outrage. But they could be anywhere in the world, hidden, buried, or invisible.
I'm glad to see you appreciate the magnitude of the problem, said Dumbledore calmly. But firstly, no, Harry, not 7 Horcruxes, 6. The 7th part of his soul, however maimed, resides inside his regenerated body. That was the part of him that lived a spectral existence for so many years during his exile. Without that, he has no self at all. That 7th piece of soul will be the last that anybody wishing to kill Voldemort must attack, the piece that lives in his body.
But the 6 Horcruxes, then, said Harry a little desperately. How are we supposed to find them?
You are forgetting. You have already destroyed one of them, and I have destroyed another.
You have? Said Harry eagerly.
Yes, indeed, said Dumbledore, and he raised his blackened, burned-looking hand. The ring, Harry. Marvolo's ring. And a terrible curse there was upon it, too. Had it not been, forgive me the lack of seemly modesty, for my own prodigious skill, and for Professor Snape's timely action when I returned to Hogwarts desperately injured, I might not have lived to tell the tale. However, a withered hand does not seem an unreasonable exchange for a 7th of Voldemort's soul. The ring is no longer a Horcrux.
But how did you find it?
Well, as you now know, I have made it my business for many years to discover as much as I can about Voldemort's past life. I have travelled widely, visiting those places he once knew. I stumbled across the ring hidden in the ruin of the Gaunt's house. It seems that once Voldemort had succeeded in sealing a piece of his soul inside it, he did not want to wear it any more. He hid it, protected by many powerful enchantments, in the shack where his ancestors had once lived,
Morfin having been carted off to Azkaban, of course, never guessing that I might one day take the trouble to visit the ruin, or that I might be keeping an eye open for traces of magical concealment. However, we should not congratulate ourselves too heartily. You destroyed the diary, and I the ring. But if we are right in our theory of a seven-part soul, four Horcruxes remain.
And they could be anything, said Harry. They could be old tin cans, or, I don't know, empty potion bottles.
You are thinking of portkeys, Harry, which must be ordinary objects easy to overlook. But Lord Voldemort used tin cans or old potion bottles to guard his own precious soul. You are forgetting what I have shown you. Lord Voldemort liked to collect trophies, and he preferred objects with a powerful magical history. His pride, his belief in his own superiority, his determination to carve for himself a startling place in magical history. These things suggest to me that Voldemort would have chosen his Horcruxes with some care, favouring objects worthy of the honour.
The diary wasn't that special.
The diary, as you have said yourself, was proof that he was the heir of Slytherin. I am sure that Voldemort considered it of stupendous importance.
So the other Horcruxes, said Harry. Do you think you know what they are, sir?
I can only guess, said Dumbledore. For the reasons I have already given, I believe that Lord Voldemort would prefer objects that in themselves have a certain grandeur. I have therefore trawled back through Voldemort's past to see if I can find evidence that such artifacts have disappeared around him.
The locket! Said Harry loudly. Hufflepuff's cup!
Yes, said Dumbledore, smiling. I would be prepared to bet, perhaps not my other hand, but a couple of fingers, that they became Horcruxes 3 and 4. The remaining two, assuming again that he created a total of 6, are more of a problem, but I will hazard a guess that having secured objects from Hufflepuff and Slytherin, he set out to track down objects owned by Gryffindor or Ravenclaw. 4 objects from the 4 founders would, I am sure, have exerted a powerful pull over Voldemort's imagination. I cannot answer for whether he ever managed to find anything of Ravenclaw's. I am confident, however, that the only known relic of Gryffindor remains safe. Dumbledore pointed his blackened fingers to the wall behind him, where a ruby-encrusted sword reposed within a glass case.
"Do you think that's why he really wanted to come back to Hogwarts, sir?" said Harry, "to try and find something from one of the other founders?"
"My thoughts precisely," said Dumbledore. "But unfortunately that does not advance us much further, for he was turned away, or so I believe, without the chance to search the school. I am forced to conclude that he never fulfilled his ambition of collecting 4 founders' objects. He definitely had 2. He may have found 3. That is the best we can do for now. Even if he got something of Ravenclaw's or of Gryffindor's, that leaves a 6th Horcrux," said Harry, counting on his fingers.
"Unless he got both."
"I don't think so," said Dumbledore. "I think I know what the 6th Horcrux is. I wonder what you will say when I confess that I've been curious for a while about the behaviour of the snake Nagini."
"The snake?" said Harry, startled. "You can use animals as Horcruxes."
"Well, it is inadvisable to do so," said Dumbledore, "because to confide a part of your soul to something that can think and move for itself is obviously a very risky business. However, if my calculations are correct, Voldemort was still at least 1 Horcrux short of his goal of 6 when he entered your parents' house with the intention of killing you. He seems to have reserved the process of making Horcruxes for particularly significant deaths. You would certainly have been that. He believed that in killing you, he was destroying the danger the prophecy had outlined. He believed he was making himself invincible.
I am sure that he was intending to make his final horcrux with your death. As we know, he failed. After an interval of some years, however, he used Nagini to kill an old muggle man, and it might then have occurred to him to turn her into his last horcrux. She underlines the Slytherin connection, which enhances Lord Voldemort's mystique. I think he is perhaps as fond of her as he can be of anything. He certainly likes to keep her close, and he seems to have an unusual amount of control over her, even for a parcel-mouth.
So, said Harry, the diary's gone, the ring's gone, the cup, the locket and the snake are still intact, and you think there might be a horcrux that was once Ravenclaw's or Gryffindor's?
An admirably succinct and accurate summary, yes, said Dumbledore, bowing his head.
So, are you still looking for them, sir? Is that where you've been going when you've been leaving the school?
Correct, said Dumbledore. I have been looking for a very long time. I think, perhaps, I may be close to finding another one. There are hopeful signs.
And if you do, said Harry quickly, can I come with you and help get rid of it?
Dumbledore looked at Harry very intently for a moment before saying, yes, I think so.
I can, said Harry, thoroughly taken aback.
Oh, yes, said Dumbledore, smiling slightly. I think you have earned that right.